I say, good to be back, which is not to say that I did not enjoy my time away. As some of you know, among my doings in this past few weeks was spending some time with Rick Mastin at his home in Big Sur, gathering stories of his 40-plus years as a UU minister, poet, songster, and troubadour, which we hope that we will eventually parlay into a book. I spent a good deal of the rest of the time beginning to work on that. So that was part of the sabbatical. Some of you remember when Rick was here back in October, what a delightful time we had with him. But that was another thing I did on this thing was a speaking tour for my beat book with four places, four venues all together. And that was an interesting experience as well, in that I found that I could ramble on for 20, 30, sometimes even more minutes than that, with hardly any kind of notes in front of me, just kind of take off and go, which served to remind me that I can ramble on far, far too long if I don't keep to a script. And actually, it was my wife, Michelle, who would remind me of these things. We'd be leaving a place where I'd done a reading. She said, "You went on way too long back there. You were starting to lose people." I thought, yeah, well, that probably happens most Sundays too, so. But being reminded of my verbosity was really not the most interesting part of my little book tour, since there's only so much interest to be gained in being reminded of certain things about yourself that you already know and would just assume not be reminded of. But anyway, the interesting thing was that, unlike this situation in here this morning and the way it is for me on most Sunday mornings, I was speaking to almost exclusively non-Unitarian Universalist gatherings and audiences, and to generally people who were not particularly familiar with Unitarian Universalism. And so I would be introduced as a minister who had written a book about God and the Beat Generation, with the assumption, or the presumption being, that I knew something about both. And the next thing I knew, I'd be talking to a room full of people, most of whom, as I say, were folk I didn't know about God. And in addition to not knowing who I was talking to, I found I didn't quite know what I was talking about either when it came to my invoking of God. But what I hope to show a little bit later is that this kind of knowing is really not a bad thing. In fact, it's a good and necessary thing if one is to speak honestly of God at all. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. But while I was rather gingerly talking of God over the past few weeks, there were others who were invoking the term with an apparent great deal of certainty. The most bizarre instance, I feel, came from the mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Ray Day, who opined that Hurricane Katrina was evidence that God was mad at African Americans for not, as he put it, taking good care of ourselves. Well, I can appreciate the fact that this man has been under a great deal of stress and strain over the past 5 months, and I'm not sure if I had to deal with some of the stuff that he's dealing with, what would be coming out of my mouth either. But please, Mr. Mayor, I would say just take a deep breath and do what you have to do, and don't go laying anything on either God or African Americans. In a much more serious and disturbing vein, one of the newly elected Palestinian leaders from the Hamas party, brought to us by way of democracy in the Middle East, stated that it was the clear will of Allah that the nation of Israel be destroyed. How well the Hamas party will continue to be served by such dangerous and unacceptable rhetoric now that they actually have to govern remains to be seen. But what they offer in this particular instance, anyway, is one of the more extreme examples of the God is on our side mentality and the certitude that accompanies such a sentiment and that justifies anything done in the name of God. But I'd have to say the prize, at least in this country, for the most outlandish invocation of God award went once again to Reverend Pat Robertson. For his assertion that the stroke suffered by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was a punishment from God for Mr. Sharon's being too accommodating towards the Palestinians. I won't even try to unravel that. I mean, gee whiz. Yes, he apologized to that, as he's had to apologize and scrape his shoes off a few other times when he stepped in it, but to the best of my knowledge, Reverend Pat has still let stand the assertion that he made either just before or after this that the good citizens of Devon, Pennsylvania might somehow be subjected to the wrath of God, since the teaching of intelligent design as an alternative to evolution in the public schools has been overruled by a judge. Don't try to unravel that either. No, really, what perplexes and even frightens me a bit about Reverend Robinson's invocations of God are not that he goes around making absurd statements about God, because lots of people do that. It's just that such statements are given national exposure, because I presume the large following this man manages to maintain. I cannot figure out why these kinds of statements continue to play to a national audience in the way that they do. It's quite nonsensical. But speaking of nonsense, I can pretty much promise you, somewhere around 10:30 this evening, as the post-game interviews take place, God will be given due credit for bringing a Super Bowl victory to either the Steelers or the Seahawks. Trust me on this one. Turn your TVs on. You know, count how many times that God gets credit for whichever team wins that thing. Now, we know that's nonsense, because we really know that God is on the side of the Patriots. And it was really the Almighty who caused those 5 turnovers in that Broncos game 3 weeks ago just to give us New Englanders a lesson in humility, so we will be toughened up all the more come next year. You see how easy it is to spin God? I can just do it like that, right off the top of my head. Do it just as well as Reverend Robinson and make about as much sense. But just for the record, I will be pulling for the Steelers this evening. Got nothing to do with God. It's really because I'm curious as to what Steeler coaches Bill Cowher's face would look like with a smile on it. I just want to see that. Right. Well, anyway, once you dispense with all the nonsense, some of it irksome, some of it dangerous, some of it just plain silly, about the ways in which the name of God is invoked, then are you really left with anything at all? Is there any honest meaning found in the name? For this is a question that I have grappled with a variety of ways for much of my adult life. Why is one I feel the need to continue to grapple with is another one of the unsolved mysteries of my life, but I've accepted it, and there it is. And I have decided, though, that the most honest approach it comes when speaking of God is to acknowledge, as I said earlier at the outset, that you quite literally do not know what or who you're talking about. And that could be a good thing. I take a cue here from one of my colleagues in the Unitarian Universalist Ministry, the Reverend Rosemary Gray McNatt. She's a very wonderfully talented, insightful African-American woman who ministers to one of our New York City UU congregations. And I find wisdom in these words of hers. Most of the great Western theologians agree on at least this. God is beyond naming or fully understanding, yet we human beings are called to make the attempt. It is the free faith of Unitarian Universalism that makes my attempts worthwhile. I think the reason I resonate so strongly with these words is that, as I say, for reasons I cannot fully explain, I too feel called to make the attempt of which Rosemary McNatt speaks. And as I just noted, it is an attempt I've made in a variety of ways over the course of my life. One of the things I spoke about on this little mini book tour that I did over these past few weeks is a highly condensed version of the second chapter of my Deep Place of God book, where I wrote about the 4 landscapes, that I call them, that my own religious and spiritual odyssey has taken me, and my attempts to speak of God or not in each one of them. Some of you have heard me speak of these landscapes before, so very briefly, just a Cliff Notes version this morning is, the first 3 are 1, the evangelical and near fundamentalist Baptist landscape of my youth and adolescence, and then 2, the liberal mainline theistic Protestantism that took me from my late college days through seminary and into my early years in the ministry, and then 3, there was the agnostic humanist landscape that I moved into when even the most liberally understood idea of a willful and supernatural supreme being ceased to hold water for me. But then, somewhere in the course of my moving across that 3rd landscape, part of which has taken place over the course of my ministry here, I found myself facing something of a spiritual void. I knew, and I still know, that a return to liberal theism would not address that void. There was no going back to the other two landscapes that I had made it across. But I found I was looking for a language and for some good metaphors for what I sensed and do sense was and is a holy or sacred dimension to life that is somehow contained within this often fallen and broken world in which we live, in which we are called to live in some meaningful way. I became aware of a need in my own life for what our current Unitarian Universalist Association President William Sinkford would later call a language of reverence. And so this is the fourth landscape that I began to work my way into. The landscape where the presence of the holy or the sacred might possibly be found in the midst of the mundane and the fallen. And one of the metaphors I found for such a landscape, which did not include invoking the name of God at all, but one of the metaphors I found for such a landscape is in Allen Ginsberg's poem, Sunflower Sutra, to which I've also devoted a chapter in that book, and I think I spoke a little bit about that here last fall. It's the poem that Dick Wigut illustrated so nicely for the cover of it. In this poem, Ginsberg poetically recalls how one day, one summer of 1955, he saw a sunflower struggling to live and show forth its beauty in the midst of a dirty, grimy, oily San Francisco railroad yard. And then he looked at the sunflower and realized it was something of a metaphor for what was going on in his own life and in his own soul, and by extension, our lives and souls. And Ginsberg wrote toward the end of his poem, "We are not our skin of grime. We are not our dread, bleak, dusty, imageless locomotive. We're all beautiful, golden sunflowers inside." And then the poem moves on to its conclusion from there. So Ginsberg's sunflower is his metaphor. It points to the presence of the sacred within the ordinary, including the ordinariness of our lives. And it wasn't too hard of a step for me to recast or reimagine God not as a being, supreme or otherwise, but as a presence. The presence, as I say, of the holy within the mundane. And so Ginsberg's sunflower then is the beat face of God. Well, a $10 word for this kind of understanding God is one I've used before. Panentheism. Move from that a little bit. For a language of reverence, though, whether it includes God language or not, also has to speak then to more than just what is going on inside of us. For to leave it at that leaves one with not much more than spiritual narcissism. There seems to be a certain amount of that going around these days, and that's the topic for another sermon. So I take my cue on this one from the passage I read a few minutes ago, from Gary Kowalski's book, Science and the Search for God. Gary, as I say, he's someone whose friendship I have enjoyed for nearly as long as I've been the minister here, since we're both in the same district, and we were both kind of writing our own God books right at about the same time. He got his out a couple of years ahead of me. And Gary's approach is a little more scientific, mine's more poetic, but we both kind of wind up in pretty much the same place. Well, Gary, in the lines I read here, draws on an experience by the late Charles Hartshorne. Dr. Hartshorne was a very remarkable man. He wrote and taught widely in the field of philosophy of religion. He was a proponent of that panentheism to which I just referred. He was a Unitarian Universalist, and he lived to be 103 years old when he passed away in the year 2000. I'm not sure if all four of those things are linked together or not. I think when he died, one of his obituaries noted it was a UU and said it was, asked if there was a connection between being a UU and living that long. I don't know. Anyway, I'm not sure there's a connection, but I do know that I did have the pleasure of having dinner one evening with Dr. Hartshorne when he was in his late 80s. And what I recall, he was sharp as a whip then, and he still had about 20 years worth of life still in him. Well, in his autobiography, which Gary Kowalski then picks up and retells in his book, Hartshorne recalls being in the midst of some despondent and gloomy wartime reflections in World War I France. You may remember, up to that point, World War I was the most devastating, death-inducing, death-bringing on war that human beings had fought up to that point. So Hartshorne is having these rather despondent, gloomy wartime reflections. He's part of an occupying force in France. And he sees his schoolyard full of happy, French, playful children just playing and having a good time. And his realization is, I am only a tiny fragment of human life. The rest of it is not at all unfortunate or wretched. And then that same realization by Hartshorne moves beyond the human, in the form of those happy children, to the earth and the landscape and the universe that he looks out past the schoolyard. As Reverend Kowalski tells it, he, Hartshorne, realized that the landscape he beheld was endowed with feeling, and that instance of sympathetic identification with the world made an impression that would last. Here again, this to me is what it means or can mean to believe in God, whether one invokes the term or not. It is not to believe in the existence of a deity. It is not to feel that one is under the rule or sway of a supreme being. But rather, it is to come to the realization that while my own life, yes, does indeed have that divine spark that Ralph Waldo Emerson said was in each of us, I am also but a tiny fragment of life. And yet, this tiny fragment that I am also lives in what Hartshorne called sympathetic identity with the rest of the world. In other words, as Dr. Hartshorne himself discovered, it's not just about me. It's about all with whom I am in relationship with. The sacredness that I find in myself is really a part of a larger sacredness that is in all of us and in all of being. And it is out of this awareness of this kind of relationship that the thing comes to us, the call to compassion, the call to love, the call to be peacemakers, and the call to be justice makers. The final days of my sabbatical were marked by the loss to our nation, indeed our world, a very remarkable woman in Coretta Scott King, whose service will be held, I believe, a little later this week, maybe today. In fact, in these past 2 months, two women who played pivotal and ongoing roles in one of the most transformative events in our nation in the 20th century, the Civil Rights Movement, both passed away, Mrs. King and Rosa Parks. These were two women whose lives were often placed at risk on behalf of that cause. And it is a memory I have of Mrs. King that gets me to my final point of the morning. I saw, as best my memory serves, Coretta Scott King only once in my life. It was in late January, early February, right about this time of year, 1969, with some of my fellow seminarians, along with clergy and lay leaders from around the country and from a wide variety of faith communities and traditions, I was in Washington, D.C., for about a 2 to 3 day gathering of an organization called Clergy and Laity, concerned about Vietnam. And that was a very sobering, if not despairing, time right then. For 1 year earlier, at a similar gathering of this organization, also in the nation's capital, those of us, and I was there also, who had made it to that one, heard a very stirring address by Dr. King himself. And now 12 months have gone by. Dr. King had been murdered, as had Robert Kennedy. Many of our cities had erupted in urban riots the previous summer. Sometime in the course of that year, the number of American soldiers dead in Vietnam passed the 50,000 mark. And the number of slain Vietnamese civilians exceeded that count by several fold. And I know I was feeling personally pretty good about the life that I envisioned before me. There in my 23rd year of life, just 1 year older than my son is now. But despite all that, it was still not a very happy time in the bigger picture. Well, Coretta Scott King addressed one of our large gatherings during that 2 or 3 days. I remember very little of what she said, actually. What I mostly remember is her calm, dignified, and measured, and determined presence that spoke a message that far transcended her words. Remember, this is only 8, 9 months after Dr. King had been killed. I do remember, however, one thing she said. She referred to a passage her late husband was fond of citing, and she asked us to keep it in mind and keep it in our hearts and not lose faith in its message as the days went on. And the line went, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Try it again. "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Now, what I would not learn until several years later was that these words were originally voiced by the 19th century Unitarian minister, the Reverend Theodore Parker, in his role as one of the leading abolitionists of his day. "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." Well, what Theodore Parker, Dr. King, and Mrs. King were saying with these words is that there is something about life, mine and yours, and the light of the world and the universe, there's something about life that contains within it a call or an urge to move towards greater wholeness, greater healing, greater justice that's to be found. And it's calling us somewhere beyond the fragmented, often broken parts of our life and our world. As I say, Parker's metaphor for that urge towards greater wholeness and fulfillment was what he called the moral arc. The call to our better selves, both personally and as a human race. And no matter how desperate or fallen the times may seem, as they certainly did in those early weeks of 1969, that moral arc is still reaching into the future and is beckoning us to be its agents, if indeed it is going to continue to keep moving. And so to heed the call of that moral arc bending towards justice is, I believe, yet another way of believing in God. Believing that is in the of not giving up on who we as people of faith may yet become and may yet cause to happen. This was the message Mrs. King was looking to give to her listeners on a very cold winter day many years ago. It is no less timely now than it was then. So by whatever name we may use, I think we are called to live meaningfully and devotedly and as compassionately as we can in this greater web of life that ultimately sustains us and nurtures us and surrounds us and envelops us. Our closing hymn sings of that web, number 175. Let's sing that together.